Resistor, capacitor, current, drag.
My name is Shrukalata.
Human being, a circuit board.
Engineer by day.
Resistor, capacitor.
Belly dancer by night.
There is a child sitting in the middle of the circuit board.
Current.
A child formed in Egypt,
drag.
But not of Egypt, not of anywhere.
24/7 refugee.
Resist, capacitor.
Nice to meet you.
It's very nice to meet you as well. It strikes me that, you know, I have a very conventional upbringing for an engineer. I'm actually a white middle-class man. Couldn't be more stereotypical engineer. And I came from a very traditional background in Britain. You're certainly not that. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about how you came to be the engineer you are now.
Sure. So I remember one of my earliest memories kind of realizing that the people on my TV are not actually tiny little people living inside it. And for me, that was crazy. How do humans make this? And I didn't know that it was called engineering or electronics then. I just thought it was called magic, and I knew I wanted to be that magician when I grew up. And actually, had I been introduced to it as engineering, I might have never had that interest in it. These kind of traditional terms always shout at me that I don't belong. There is no space for me in that term. You have all of these connotations with the term, and you have this limited idea and limited view. And I think that's a problem.
I suppose everyone's sort of job and has sort of kind of baggage associated with it. And the baggage associated with engineering isn't selling itself very well, let's put it that way. It's not got great associations, has it, in many ways?
But I'm also, you know, kind of, because we're telling creative people that you do not have a space in engineering, and I'm just like, how many amazing creative technologies are we missing out on today as a society? Because we're telling these people with the amazing ideas that they don't belong here.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, I think engineering is immensely creative. I spend my time thinking, obviously I'm in acoustics, but thinking about how do I make this work to make it sound better? And that's a very creative process.
Inventive.
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 So you've got this really interesting, diverse background, having been a refugee.
Sure. Like I said, engineering was this magic to me. And once I grew older and understood that it was engineering, I was like, okay, so these are subjects I need to concentrate on. So I studied really hard and just so excited that one day I'm going to go and study this magic at university and not just be among all of these male students, but I was also going to be one of the youngest to ever study it. And then my family arrived to the UK in 2007. I didn't really know what I was going. I didn't really understand what the term asylum seeker meant. It was the first time I heard it. And then they said that they're moving us to Wales. And I was like, wait, I thought Wales were the fish. And anyway, we ended up in Wales, my adopted home now. And I went to school. I finished my A-levels. And then I was so excited to finally apply to university to study this magic. And then I found out that I couldn't. Not because I was incapable, but because I was an asylum seeker. So I joined a campaign called Equal Access for Asylum Seekers to Higher Education. Very, very snappy name. And right now I'm really excited to say this campaign has been successful at more than 75 universities in the UK. And I think there's only about 108 universities in the whole country. So hopefully that the whole country will allow asylum seekers to access university is a dream that can be a reality really soon. And I'm sure with other people listening now, with their help, it can be a reality.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the really impressive things reading about what you've done is, you know, you're campaigning for refugees in education. And, you know, you got awards like UNHCR Young Women of the Year on the back of this kind of campaign. So things are improving compared to what you faced.
I think so. I think sadly, since the Alan Kurdi case, if people are not familiar with Alan Kurdi, it's the little boy who was found dead on a beach trying to escape persecution. I think since that, I've noticed a shift in how people treat refugees. So my family were deported in 2012. It was an immigration dawn raid on my family home, and I happened to be asleep at a friend's house that night. I wasn't at home that night, and the rest of my family got deported. I was the only person who was left behind. And somebody filmed that deportation. It had tens of thousands of views on YouTube, and going through the comments, they were things like, thanks, you know, freeze up a house for a proper English family, go, don't come back. It was very, very hard. It was really, really difficult. And I feel like if this would happen now, I don't think I would be met with the same kind of harshness.
I mean, that's, you know, I can't quite imagine.
It was difficult.
Yeah, but thinking about it, to suddenly find your family has disappeared and you're left on your own in a country.
It was difficult. And, you know, it was just, I was left in a country that they're not allowed access to, and they were deported to a country that I don't have access to. I'm not allowed to visit Egypt. So, yeah, it is difficult.
So have you managed to visit your family somewhere in between times, or are you just...
I saw my mum once since 2012. Traveling, especially if you're fleeing persecution, is not the norm as it is here, if that makes sense.
It does. I mean, it's obviously not the norm at the moment, but yeah, normally you don't...
Yeah.
You know, we're all doing it like this, but you've had it enforced for you a lot longer. Mm. And that must be incredibly hard.
What was harder was going through the asylum process itself, and it took about 6 years, but that was 6 years of not knowing whether you're going to be in the country tomorrow, not knowing if what tomorrow holds, 6 years of not being allowed access to university or able to work or access to benefits, and being met with people who tell you that you are simultaneously stealing the jobs and their benefits at the same time. So I think that was the hardest part, being in limbo for years.
Yes, I mean, I'm glad I've never had to face such difficulties. I mean, it just sounds horrendous.
I'm glad you haven't either.
But you did eventually, you got asylum, and that allowed you to go to Cardiff University.
Yeah. It was an incredible opportunity. It was a miracle has happened. And, you know, my family had been deported not that long before. My mental state was not good, but I wasn't going to let this go to waste. And the first thing I did when I heard that I'm going to get my documents was apply to university to study electrical and electronic engineering at Cardiff.
And yes, it's great that you have, because of the great jobs you're now doing in engineering. We've had to wait 6 years to have your talents.
Thank you.
What a sort of kind of waste of resource for the country, if you want to put it that way as well.
And, you know, we need to produce more than 186,000 engineers every single year, not in total, every single year, just to meet our engineering shortfall by 2024. And at the same time, we are preventing people from accessing engineering, people that exist in this country today, people who are good at engineering, people who are good at the jobs. We're telling them you can't access it, and it just makes no sense, no economic sense at all.
I've seen you say a true scientist always asks why. Can you unpick that for me?
So I really remember this so vividly. I think I was in year two, and my science teacher told me a true scientist always asks themselves why. And since then, I've always asked myself why, you know, but why does this move? But why does this exist that way? Why does this thing reflect light? I think for me, that's kind of what made me into an engineer.
And is that true of an engineer? They always have to be asking why as well?
I don't think there's one form of engineering, and I don't think that there is one trail of thought that makes a good engineer. You know, you can get that through different ways. For me specifically, that's what worked for me.
Tell us a little bit about what you do in engineering at the moment. You work for LV. What's your day job like?
Yes. So I work in femtech. Femtech means making technology primarily for women, but the tech I make helps cisgender women, transgender men, and basically anybody who has given birth or has this sort of anatomy. So I'm making things like silent breast pumps. It took more than 160 years to realize that people who breastfeed do not want to be treated like dairy cows, or pelvic floor trainers. But before that, I worked in industrial robotics. So I worked on robots that can measure things as small as a single nanometer, which is 60,000 times than the width of a human hair. I've built a machine that can detect things like cancer based on electron quantum spin. I made a system that can help with eye surgery. So I worked with eye surgeons on the system, actually. And I think being an engineer just means you can do whatever you want.